Well, good evening. Welcome. I'm Horton Beebe Center and president of Eurasia Foundation, and I am delighted to welcome you to this celebration of Eurasia Foundation's 20th anniversary. Now, I don't know about you guys, but the older I get, the more I enjoy other people's birthdays, which is very different from my daughter, Roxy, who just turned 8, and she really prefers her own birthday. But I hope that you guys will enjoy our birthday this evening. I want to thank you all for coming. I know there are lots of other things you could be doing tonight, but the fact that you have voted with your feet and decided to be with us means the world to us. I particularly want to thank some folks who have been very important to us over the last few decades. First of all, our distinguished guests from the U.S. government who are here with us tonight. The U.S. government is our longest and strongest partner. Our friends and partners from other governments in Eurasia, in Europe, and in the Middle East, and our friends and partners from the private and the nonprofit sectors. Now, looking back on the past 20 years, I suppose that Eurasia Foundation is a lot like other organizations. When we're not leaping from strength to strength, we seem to be lurching from crisis to crisis. But through it all, it's people like you in this room, and many others beyond this room, in the large and growing Eurasia Foundation diaspora that shine through. You make our work possible with your enthusiasm, your advice, your time, and together we have achieved a great deal. Starting with our first grant 20 years ago, Eurasia Foundation has been instrumental in developing some of the leading nonprofits, media outlets, and universities in the Eurasia region, and has transformed entire sectors, such as retail banking in Armenia, economics education in Ukraine, and independent media in Kyrgyzstan. Over the years, we've evolved from a U.S.-based organization with field offices into a unique network of 6 autonomous institutions, with local foundations covering the entire Eurasia region. And today, we apply 2 decades of experience with communities in transition to a broader geography, with programs in the Middle East and China. Now, it's notoriously difficult to quantify the impact of a charitable organization like Eurasia. There are the figures, for instance, hundreds of millions of dollars invested in programs, and thousands of jobs created and grants made. And there's tangible evidence, like the institutions we helped establish many years ago that are still hard at work. But for me, a crucial measure of success is the people with whom we've had the privilege to associate. People like Bill Frenzel, our founding chairman, Sarah Carey, whose spirit we celebrate tonight, Bill Maines, who inspired the exchange program named for him, Rocky Staples, who essentially designed Eurasia Foundation from scratch, and Bob Zelick, a former trustee and our speaker tonight. These extraordinary people, and many others who have served as trustees, advisors, staff, partners, and friends over the last 2 decades, have a gravitational pull that draws us closer together and aligns us in common purpose, and that is to promote the prosperity of people and the stability of societies that may be far removed from us geographically, but whose well-being is linked to our own. So for me, this room tonight, and all of you in it, is an important measure of the Foundation's impact. With that thought in mind, I want to thank everyone who contributed to tonight's event. In your programs, you'll find lists of our host committee and our honorary committee, as well as all of our sponsors. The support that you've given us has made this evening possible, and I want to thank you. I also want to recognize the great staff of Eurasia Foundation, under the leadership of Rob O'Donovan, who have done the 1,001 things necessary to organize this sort of event. So let's thank our great team. Now, a quick look at tonight's program. In a moment, we'll screen a brief video of Eurasia Foundation's work. We'll then have our first course, and after that, our chairman, Jan Kalitsky, will introduce the Sarah Carey program, and the award will be presented to Senator Lugar by a very special guest. Following the main course, our dinner committee chairman, Drew Guff, will introduce our keynote speaker, Bob Zelek. Dessert and coffee will follow, and the formal proceedings will end at 9 o'clock sharp. So, please enjoy the evening, and please turn your attention to the screen.
How do you measure a foundation's impact? Without Eurasia Foundation, the Kiev School of Economics, the Russian Association of Independent Newspapers, and the Caucasus Barometer Household Opinion Survey, these trailblazing institutions and many others like them would simply not exist. Eurasia Foundation gives people the tools they need to make the change they choose. For 20 years, Eurasia Foundation has created better schools, jobs, and governments. Now the foundation applies its expertise well beyond Eurasia to China and the Middle East.
For many years, Eurasia Foundation has changed lives of many people in my country of Ukraine. It has changed my life too.
The government in Belarus shut down European Humanities University in 2004 for supporting independent thought. Undeterred, the university reopened in neighboring Lithuania and became the world's only university in exile. Thanks to vigorous moral and financial support from Eurasia Foundation, Western governments, and universities, students can now pursue an education, voice opinions, and explore ideas without reprisal.
EHU is a real European and Western model.
Professors respect their students.
For me, it's a place of freedom.
Everyone has his own opinion.
It is unique.
EHU graduates are politicians, business leaders, and rock stars. In its 20th year, EHU continues to grow and provide young people with outstanding education and unparalleled opportunities. Eurasia Foundation brings know-how and funding to aspiring entrepreneurs and nonprofit leaders in closed societies like Iran. The foundation operates schools that offer courses in entrepreneurship, civic education, community development, and family law using innovative online methods like this instructional video.
از انتقادات دیگران استقبال کنیم.
More than 7,000 Iranians have joined our school websites, launching more than 100 community development projects and starting dozens of businesses. A group of students from Tehran founded an NGO that teaches children to protect the environment, educating nearly 1,500 students through workshops and musical performances, and building a new generation of environmentally conscious Iranians. In a region where the media rarely challenge authorities, young Kyrgyz journalist Zarima Sultanbekova exposed a school principal who beat a student. Appearing on the independent news website Klub, her story pushed the Ministry of Education to investigate and eventually fire the principal, an almost unprecedented move. Breaking this story opened doors for Zarima. She was invited to cover the 2012 U.S. presidential elections on a State Department exchange. Klub does far more than report the news. It trains hundreds of aspiring young journalists to ask tough questions, use multiple sources, and look for unique story angles. With Eurasia Foundation support, Klub has expanded to southern Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Kazakhstan.
Really, they're young, but they're taking a very innovative approach to journalism in Central Asia.
Besides journalists, Eurasia Foundation offers opportunities to politicians, academics, and business people handpicked for tailored exchanges to Washington, D.C. Fellows include Eka Saratse-Delaney, Georgia's new ambassador to France, and Marinika Babanazarova, director of the Savitsky Carol Kapakstan Art Museum, who brought international attention to an unknown school of Russian artists who settled in Uzbekistan. In Washington, Marinika met curators of the Smithsonian and Phillips collection, contacts who may enable her to expand what's on view in her museum.
Culture makes us different and unique, but it is what unites us and is understandable to anyone.
The culture of Eurasia Foundation is to connect people. From Tunis to Vladivostok, we broaden horizons so people can make the change they choose.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear guests, if I could have your attention for a moment, I now have the pleasure of introducing a person whose public service ranges from Capitol Hill to the State Department, from the Commerce Department to the White House, an investment banker and energy company executive, an academic, and a published author. Please join me in welcoming a statesman and scholar, Eurasia Foundation's Chairman of the Board of Trustees, Jan Kalitsky.
Well, good evening, all, and I think what Horton was trying to tell you is I can't hold down a job. I have lots of pleasure being chairman of Eurasia Foundation, and I'll just mention two of them, but it's really a very challenging and interesting job. One great pleasure is to work jointly with those regional affiliates that Horton was telling you about. It's just extraordinary how, with very little funding, and really very small funding, they can do so much in our space, in the Eurasian space, and we look forward to making that happen also in adjoining areas, as you heard. And you have these terrific up-by-the-bootstrap programs to help develop young leaders and empower communities who face human challenges of all kinds. And, you know, you think on the one hand of a school of economics or on the other hand of disadvantaged women who are trying to get their product to market, to people hearing on the internet from the foundation, because if we were operating in their vicinity, it wouldn't be good for them or for us. So I'm pleased about that. I'm also pleased that we recognized that we could operate not only in the former Soviet states, but also such areas as Western China, as Horton mentioned, and the Middle East now, because a number of things are happening there that we have a skill set that relates to, so we're quite interested and excited about that. But there's another great pleasure for me as chairman, and that is to spend special evenings like this looking around and seeing so many old friends and people who share our sense of mission about this region and about the lessons that we have learned from it. And when you think about the history of the foundation from the first Bush administration, which, to its credit, great credit, established this, and then receiving really the bipartisan support of administration after administration for this work, I think it's a great story. It's not as well understood as we would like, but we're depending on you to spread it. I'd like to especially thank our generous donors, those in the U.S. government, also those in foreign governments, including very good friends in Europe who are supporting us because they view us as a very effective organization for their own purposes in the area. We'd like to also thank all of our individual supporters and the board of Eurasia Foundation and the Advisory Council, our alumni and our staffs. And really, the staffs have such incredible enthusiasm. It's infectious. And I remember at one point going to Almaty and talking to some older members of the board. But then when I got around to talking to the staff, and including interns who were unpaid, who were just working their heads off because they really had a sense of commitment to the mission of Eurasia Foundation of Central Asia, one of our regional affiliates. Let me also offer special deep thanks to our dinner chair, Drew Goff, and our dinner vice chair, Gene Lawson, and the members of their host and honorary committees. Drew and Gene, you were absolutely indispensable to our success this evening, so would you mind standing and accepting our gratitude for your dedication? Tonight's dinner honors our late and longtime chair, Sarah Carey, and those of you who knew her can understand why we honor her through a dedicated program. Sarah was a person of tremendous drive, unrelenting optimism, a great believer in the power of getting good people to do good together. In the old Russian pairing of words and deeds, Sarah, as a lawyer, thought words were fine, but deeds, that's what matters. That's where the action is. So it's an honor to honor Sarah, to think of her spirit, to keep getting things done for the greater good. And for that reason, we launched the Sarah Carey program 1 year ago. I'm delighted that Sarah's husband and their three daughters, Sasha, Sarah, and Katie, and their families are with us tonight. And if you would, please do stand up and let us thank you for joining us. It is also fitting that we are joined by most of our first class of the Sarah Carey Program's Young Professional Network. Our 32 young professionals work as journalists, think tank scholars, development professionals, analysts, economists, and bloggers. Think about that. Every month this year, they have met with a leading diplomat, journalist, or author over breakfast. Over the last year, Horton and I have gotten to know this group, and I can tell you that the Eurasia region is in good hands. If you're a member of the Young Professionals Network, please stand to be recognized. Thank you. Thank you very much. Tonight, we honor Senator Lugar and Senator Nunn for their extraordinary work. Senator Nunn had an unbreakable family obligation, but he sends his best wishes and thanks you all for honoring him with your presence here this evening. Senator Lugar, who is really a hero for many of us, will accept the award on behalf of both recipients. I'd like to highlight an unusual feature of the Sarah Carey Award. The award recipient, or in this case, recipients, are asked to identify a nonprofit organization to receive a modest grant from the Eurasia Foundation. And this year, Senators Nunn and Lugar have selected the Monterey Institute's Eurasia Nonproliferation Program, which will use the grant to deliver additional expert lectures for Al-Farabi Kazakh National University's course entitled Introduction to WMD Nonproliferation. Nothing like connecting nonproliferation with Eurasia Foundation with Kazakhstan. We can do it. The additional lectures will use the latest in online educational technology and allow program experts to share their most current research with Kazakhstani colleagues and students. So now I ask you to turn your attention to the screen for a brief video on this year's Sarah Carey Award winners. Thank you.
At the heart of every Eurasia Foundation program is an effort to connect people. The Sarah Carey program links young professionals who work on the region with each other and with experienced policymakers, gathers people for a provocative policy discussion, and recognizes extraordinary individuals with the annual Sarah Carey Award. a new generation of leaders is becoming involved in the region. In 2012, 32 outstanding young Eurasia specialists joined Eurasia Foundation's Young Professionals Network.
Professionals interested in Eurasia are really difficult to reach at times, and so this was a great opportunity to connect with my own peers who are interested in that part of the world.
The young professionals meet monthly with top diplomats like Ambassador Thomas Pickering, politicians like Rosa Atambayeva, former president of the Kyrgyz Republic, and scholars and writers like Fiona Hill and Christian Karl.
We've gotten exposure to some really fantastic senior people who have been giving us advice. They've given us mentorship about where to go, how to pursue new opportunities.
20 years ago, Phil Donahue and Vladimir Posner electrified television audiences in the U.S. and the Soviet Union with their live shows bridging political, cultural, and geographic divides.
They'll meet each other face-to-face next on A Citizen's Summit.
What has your government done for the sake of peace? Give us at least three.
For the first Sarah Carey Forum, the Eurasia Foundation reunited Posner and Donahue to discuss the tensions that still exist in U.S.-Russian relations and how 20 years later, people can still transcend the politics of the moment.
If we want a normal relationship, you've got to understand, you've got to climb up the other guy's belfry, as they say in Russian, and look at the world from that person's view.
It's amazing what can happen if we reach out instead of lashing out and see ourselves in the faces of those Soviets.
The 2013 Sarah Carey Award honors Senators Richard Lugar and Sam Nunn for their success in materially reducing the chance of nuclear catastrophe. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union, Nunn and Lugar established an international framework to safeguard and dismantle nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons.
You have to think about what real visionaries do. They look at the world and they see what's missing. So they set out to fill the gap, to build something new. And that's what Sam Nunn and Dick Lugar did many years ago. They challenged us to think anew, to imagine, after decades of confrontation, how our nations might engage in cooperation.
Nunn and Lugar were personally involved in implementing the program, traveling to many elimination sites in Russia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, as well as in the U.S. So just how successful was Nunn Lugar?
Our generation dove under desks because we were afraid of potential nuclear annihilation. And that's why I'm active. That's why I want to continue to be active, because I can make a difference in that world.
Senators Lugar and Nunn have made a tremendous difference in the world. Congratulations to the 2013 Sarah Carey Awardees.
Well, now I have a very special pleasure, which is to welcome an old friend, Secretary Madeleine Albright, to the stage. Madeleine served as the first female Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001, and we are fortunate indeed to have her as one of our honorary co-chairs for Eurasia Foundation's Advisory Council. Madeleine and I have known each other for quite a while. Might seem forever, but I can certainly promise you forever is a good way. We served two great senators, Ed Muskie and Ted Kennedy. We campaigned for candidates and programs we believed in. We had the honor of serving President Bill Clinton. But my fondest memory is when we both taught at Georgetown University, and Madeleine does that, amongst many other things these days. And Madeleine agreed to be a guest lecturer in my foreign policy class. Now, I knew it would be interesting, you know, to have Madeleine come to the class, but it was much more than that. My students were spellbound as Madeline literally brought over newly declassified NSC documents, all on the up and up, in which she had been involved, and that helped them learn at first hand what foreign policy is about, warts and all. So, Madeline, I'm really so pleased that you could join us tonight to present the Sarah Carey Award to Senator Richard Lugar. And the podium is yours.
Thank you very, very much. It's always nice to be introduced by a very good old friend. I'm old in the nicest terms. And I want to thank the Eurasia Foundation for hospitality this evening for this wonderful celebration of Sarah Carey. And this award is in its second year, as we know. And as we've seen from the video, its purpose is to support the foundation's longstanding mission in service to international understanding, prosperity, and peace. The recipients in 2013 are two former U.S. Senators, Sam Nunn, and our wonderful guest this evening, my very dear friend, Senator Lugar, whom we all admire for his creativity as a legislator, his commitment to public service, and his civility as a human being. Senator Lugar was also dedicated to his job, which I learned years ago during my confirmation hearing as Secretary of State. Naturally, I was nervous. But to my relief, the hearing went pretty smoothly until there was a vote. And the only person left was Senator Lugar. And I thought, well, a couple of more questions and we're done. So I looked hopefully at the senator, who looked patiently back at me and began to ask questions. In the next hour, we covered environmental degradation in Africa, population growth in the Middle East, democratic prospects in Ukraine, the Chilean Free Trade Agreement, regional peacekeeping operations, international financial crises, Islamic extremism, arms control, our embassy in Moscow, the Philippines, and the implications of rising energy consumption in China. And that's just a summary. It was easier to take my orals for my PhD. As a senator, Richard Lugar was very thorough, and as a legislator leader, he was supremely effective. And really, just two highlights. In 1986, he almost single-handedly reversed U.S. policy towards the Philippines, bringing America down on the side of the Corazon Aquino and the Filipino people instead of Ferdinand Marcos and 500 pairs of shoes. Half a dozen years later, in the wake of the Cold War, his legislation, as we've just heard, to safeguard nuclear materials in the former Soviet Union stopped a potential nightmare from becoming a reality. And the bottom line is the world is safer and freedom is more widespread because of the determined effort of this very wise man and his judgment. So tonight, the Eurasia Foundation is proud to present the Sarah Carey Award to a fighter for liberty, a solver of hard problems, and a doer on behalf of world peace. So please join me in honoring Indiana's favorite son and my favorite senator, Senator Richard Lugar.
Madeline, thank you so much for being with us this evening. And thanks to each one of you who have made the Eurasia Foundation so important for this world. I'm excited, as I know my partner Sam Nunn is, about Eurasia Foundation. We're deeply honored to be recognized. I'm emboldened by the introduction to mention that Sam and I were involved back in 1986 with other senators over in Geneva, Switzerland, sent by President Reagan with the hope that negotiations with the Soviet Union over the reduction of weapons of mass destruction might begin. It was a forlorn hope in 1986, but we continued to visit with Russians in the subsequent years during our travels. And to make a long story short, in a totally counterintuitive moment in history, some of the Russians that we had met, diplomats and military people, came to Washington unexpectedly, met with Sam and me around a table that I've inherited, and said, in essence, we're broke. We are out of money, and furthermore, we are losing the troops that are guarding the nuclear weapons that are aimed at you. And you ought to be concerned about that, which indeed we had been for some time. As mayor of the city of Indianapolis for 8 years, I had no idea until we really got into it with the Russians that my own city of Indianapolis and every large city in America had been targeted for annihilation, as well as all of the military installations. And there were, with the nuclear weapons there, enough firepower literally to wipe all of it off. Whether we knew about it or not is not essential now, but we did then, and we decided to move quickly at the last stages of the Congress of 91 to pass the non-nuclear legislation, and then to begin to work with the Bush administration, which went slowly during that first year of our labors, in the last year of that administration, a little more rapidly with the new administration of President Clinton that came in. But to make a long story short again, it has been a two-decades project. It has involved appropriations every year and the legislation required to do that. And it's required travel, which has been tremendously interesting, sometimes at least semi-precarious. During this past year, when things are not quite so precarious, but still the need to continue working with Russia is so imperative, I went to Moscow. I got fairly good notices in the Foreign Office, not so good notices over in the War Office. Lots of problems out in Saravatica, where missiles still are being torn down as we speak this evening, but might not be after the mid-year or maybe the end of this particular year, unless our negotiators are successful. We went on to Georgia on this occasion, to a laboratory that former President Saakashvili had set up. He had named the laboratory for me, and I was proud of that laboratory because it is at least at the fringes of noticing if things are happening in the biological or chemical warfare area. The statistics tonight were about very dramatic nuclear weapons, submarines, other carriers. The problems of WMD also include biological and chemical, as we are learning a great deal more as we think about Syria and other places. And so we are trying to work with the Georgians and with others at the fringe there. I had the privilege of proceeding on out to the Pacific on board the USS George Washington, cruising, at least I did not cruise, but I was on board the ship that has been cruising, the South China Sea, where there are a host of other problems. But we have been trying to establish with the DITRA people, Defense Threat Reduction Agency, laboratories in each of those countries, the Philippines and Thailand and Indonesia and elsewhere in Asia, so that once again we're on the frontiers of attempting to at least have some signal to Americans as well as the rest of the world if problems are going to arise. So it's a real privilege to have a chance to see very dear friends this evening. I'm grateful for this honor, and Sam likewise has asked me to tell you of his devotion to the Eurasia Foundation, the tremendous regard he has as we have seen the work of this foundation in the field. And we promise in our own ways to continue to fight the good fight, as we know that you will. More power to all of you. Thank you very much.
I now have the pleasure of introducing the chairman of tonight's dinner, someone who recognized early on the extraordinary opportunities that investments in Russia would unleash, both for Russians and Americans alike, and created the first major private equity fund investing in Russia. A Eurasia Foundation trustee, a thoughtful analyst of markets and politics in Eurasia, please join me in welcoming tonight's dinner chairman, Drew Guff.
Thank you, Horton. Good evening. I'm Drew Guff of Sigler Guff. We're a private equity firm that's been investing in the Eurasia region for more than 20 years, and the founder of Russia Partners, one of the very first private equity firms investing in Russia after the breakup of the Soviet Union. I'm also a proud member of the Eurasia Foundation's Board of Trustees. It was Sarah Carey herself who recruited me to the Eurasia Board many years ago. So it's a great pleasure to be here and see how far the Sarah Carey program has come in its very first year. I'm also very pleased that Sarah's family, Jack, Sasha, Sarah, and Katie, could join us tonight for this special occasion. Your presence here tonight and continued connection to the foundation really means the world to us. I have the pleasure of introducing Bob Zelig this evening, a man of great integrity with a profound grasp of economics, foreign policy, and politics. Bob is someone who has been able to get things done throughout a career in public service in a way that has enhanced people's respect for him. Whether they were on the side of a particular issue, his side, or in the opposition, regardless of their political orientation. As Fred Bergston said about Bob, no one on the world scene is more committed to the goals of improving global prosperity, international cooperation, and enhancing economic globalization that is both open and fair than Bob. I think that's a very fair summary of Bob's leadership over the decades. As the 11th president of the World Bank Group from 2007 to 2012, Bob brought new life to the institution. He recapitalized the bank, expanded financing for the poorest countries following the food, fuel, and financial crises. His voice was one of the first and most articulate to identify the human dimension of the global financial crisis. Bob also refocused the bank on good governance and anti-corruption, making the bank more accountable, agile, and transparent. He encouraged developing countries to set up their own priorities rather than have them dictated by the bank. Under his leadership, the World Bank and the IFC were able to play a more active role in responding to the international economic crisis than they would have otherwise. Back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the breakup of the Soviet Union, Bob served in both the State Department and the Treasury Department with Jim Baker, and it was on their watch that Eurasia Foundation was created. Bob later served as a member of the Eurasia Foundation's Board of Trustees under Sarah Carey as chair and Bill Frenzel as vice chair. In all of his service through a distinguished and continuing career, we have all benefited immensely from his experience, his wisdom, and his friendship. So, Bob, thank you for being here tonight to mark 20 years of Eurasia Foundation's good work. Please join me in welcoming Bob Zelig.
Well, thank you very much, Drew, for that extremely generous introduction, and thanks to all of you for the invitation to be with you this evening. It was a particular pleasure because I was invited by my friend Bill Frenzel, a man from whom I've learned a great deal over the years, and I understood that all of you associated with the Eurasia Foundation have also had the opportunity and enjoyed it, as I have, to come to know that Bill is the very best of partners and colleagues, one who brings wisdom, insight, plain hard work, and also a nice dose of humor, too. So, Bill, I want to have a special thanks to you. It's also a particular honor to be here with Senator Richard Lugar, who just received the very well-deserved award for the far-sighted work that he and Senator Nunn have undertaken over the years, and it's very wonderful that Secretary Albright was able to come here and be able to present the Sarah Carey Award herself. Senator Lugar has been a role model for me, and I know for many others. I told him as the dinner began, I recently had the opportunity to visit Purdue University at the invitation of President Mitch Daniels, another beneficiary of Senator Lugar's grace and decency and drive for high standards of public service. So it's with my fellow Midwesterners, Dick Lugar and Bill Frenzel, and Mitch Daniels as evidence, I'd like to posit tonight that America's true steady internationalism is rooted in the heartland of the United States. But I also want to thank all of you for the work that you do, starting with Jan and Horton for your leadership, the staff for your incredible commitments and efforts that you do every day of the year, and to the Eurasia Foundation supporters for backing this very important idea and organization. Now, as you heard a little bit, I had the opportunity to work with Secretary of State James Baker during the Bush 41 administration when we first came up with the idea of a Eurasia Foundation. We launched the notion in the bill that became the Freedom Support Act. And to give you a sense of the origin, we were trying to figure out at that time how best to assist after an incredible and unexpected event, not only the end of the Cold War that had defined our lives, but the very breakup of the Soviet Union. Now, we had launched enterprise funds in Central and Eastern Europe as those once captive nations achieved their freedom. And the idea behind those funds was to look beyond traditional forms of U.S. assistance to boost the development of their private sector. Yet we knew that Russia and the other states of Eurasia needed something different to help build open and free societies as well as private enterprise. Of course, neither we nor anyone else could forecast with any specificity how best to help. So the idea was to create this foundation, drawing on the insights, talents, experience, and learning of others, now all of you, to establish an organic, adaptable policy response. So I had a rush of memories when Horton shared with me a copy of John Stremlau's memo of January 1992 to my colleague Dennis Ross, who was then Director of Policy Planning. It was the formal recommendation of the creation of the Eurasia Foundation out of some additional assistance funds that Secretary Baker had requested. And in those days, the Policy Planning Office actually reported through my office, so I guess I had the opportunity to be present at the creation. So I'm grateful for the energies and abilities of people such as the late Sarah Carey and also Bill Maynes and many, many others who over 20 years have given great content to the raw early idea for the Eurasia Foundation. I've begun with this look back both because it's appropriate for this 20th anniversary at the start of the Asia Foundation's operation, but also because it might give us some perspective on our time and the challenges that are ahead. Today is May 9th, and this day has some historical moment, too. For the Russians, celebrate May 9th, 1945, as the day of victory in what they call the Great Patriotic War, World War II. It's been 68 tumultuous years for the Russians. Almost 22 years ago, their country, the Soviet Union, one of the victorious powers of World War II, was dissolved. Within one long lifetime, one could have witnessed the birth of the Soviet Union its invasion by Nazi Germany, the repulse, and then the march of the Red Army throughout Europe, on to the very end of the Soviet state, and then forward to today. Therefore, while this is a time of some frustration and even pessimism about Russia for many people, I suspect that the process of change in Russia has not run its course. As Novaya Gazeta journalist Andrei Kolosovnov was quoted as saying at the Gaidar Forum earlier this year, do not underestimate the unpredictable. So how might we reflect on what's happened? Well, Bill Burns, the current U.S. Deputy Secretary of State and formerly a very effective U.S. Ambassador to Russia, offered a very insightful perspective to me a number of years ago that I want to share with you. When President Putin came to power, Bill reflected, the conditions he saw around him looked like a great Russian's worst nightmare, especially for one whose worldview was that of a KGB colonel. Russia seemed to be disintegrating. Territorially, as revolts in the south threatened to eat away at the Russia that was left when the USSR broke up. Internally and institutionally, through corruption, criminality. Internationally, as Russia receded from great power standing, struggling with a sense of humiliation. In human terms, through alcohol and illness. And the economy seemed controlled by oligarchs, people who wouldn't have counted in the old order, but in the late 1990s, they and their spouses were dripping with ostentatious wealth, while Putin and the old guardians of the state struggled with a threadbare existence. So President Putin resorted to one what might have expected from a Russian KGB colonel. He sought to restore the power of the Russian state. He used police power, unleashed the military to crush opponents, reasserted control over natural resources, and established a state capitalism. Regionally, he tried to extend control over CIS neighbors. Internationally, Russia showed that it could dispense favors and cause difficulties. And Putin way overshot his drive for so-called order. Yet some things happened along the way that Putin might not have expected. The new Russia created a consumer class, not yet a middle class in my view, not yet a majority, but a new influence on the scene. And many Russians, unlike most Soviets, gained exposure to the world. While it may take time, I suspect that the attitudes of the Russian public will change over time through that experience. I believe that President Putin doesn't fully understand these new forces. His anxiety about them prompted his hostility to the movements last year and the crackdown. Putin can mobilize support in the provinces and in the state bureaucracies. The oligarchs also came to their terms. But will Russians ultimately see Putin's moves as a sign of strength or one of weakness? Can Russia be ruled and controlled if increasing numbers in Moscow and St. Petersburg no longer fully support the rulers? Now, the resolve of the West was important in the eventual demise of the Soviet Empire. But so, frankly, was oil at $15 a barrel. Gorbachev realized that the old USSR couldn't keep up. Now, economically, Russia is still very dependent on energy and energy prices. At least until recently, Russia's leaders drew down energy wealth without investing in future sources. Now, Lee Kuan Yew, who's a frank observer, if there ever were one, had this to say about Russia in a recent book of interviews that was edited by Graham Allison and Bob Blackwell. He explained that Russia, quote, has been unable to develop an economy that generates wealth independent of exports of energy and raw materials. The Russian population, he said, is declining. Alcoholism plays a role, so do pessimism, declining fertility rate, and a declining life expectancy. Siberia and Vladivostok are filling up with more and more Chinese. Lands on the bend of the Amur River will be repopulated with Chinese. The system is not functioning, he said, because it has gone haywire. Well, this is not exactly a ringing endorsement. Lee Kuan Yew concluded that Vladimir Putin's challenge is to give Russians a hopeful outlook for the future. I would add, from a strategic perspective, that Putin's Russia has permitted its historical resentments to blind it to Russia's real external challenges, which are to the south and the east, certainly not to the west. Putin's efforts to rewire the Soviet Union and Central Asia have just led to suspicions. And yet, some recent Russian officials have sought to move the economy in a better direction. Former Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin managed Russia's budget, debt, and macroeconomy with great skill. Former Economics Minister and now Sberbank CEO German Greff pushed reforms that eventually got Russia into the WTO. Russia enjoys sizable financial reserves and human capital. There seem to be prospects now for educational reforms, too. Putin recognizes the need for economic diversification, and other Russians recognize that the country has to be able to invest in human capital and the quality of institutions, including better and transparent business regulation, public administration, and the judiciary. Privatized and new enterprises comprise the fastest growing part of Russia's economy, especially small and medium-sized enterprises in the services sector. State capitalism, in contrast, leads to government capture, deeper corruption through regulations, subsidies, and protection from competition. In their new book, Mr. Putin, Cliff Gaddy and Fiona Hill contend that Putin recognizes the failures of the Soviet economy, but Putin's view of markets is one of exploiting rivals' vulnerabilities in wheeling and dealing. It's a world of making, not earning money. So how should the U.S. and others deal with today's Russia? In my view, the posturing about reset was unfortunate. It suggested that U.S. differences with Russia were just because of President Bush's policies and that a fresh start by thoughtful people would make all the difference. Frankly, I had the same skepticism about this perspective as I did when President Bush thought that he could look into Putin's heart. We need to be realistic, neither hostile nor expecting that style will change the substance. I suspect that most dealings with Russia will be transactional, and we should still look for mutual interests that we can pursue. But drawing from the historical perspective with which I began tonight, we should recognize that incredible changes of the past decades have not run their course. Working with Germany and other European partners, the U.S. should be supporting the political economic development of Russia's neighbors because their changes will affect Russia's prospects and choices too. Ukraine is critically important, yet so are Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Moldova. EU association agreements can have influence and encourage the freedom of movement of goods, services, capital, labor, and ideas. In Central Asia, although conditions are difficult, the U.S., the EU, the multilateral institutions, and other partners should encourage the management of tensions over water and energy. There are win-win possibilities, and if distrust can be overcome and practical successes can be the basis for building better ties among the Central Asian countries. The world has also learned the hard way about how to pursue resource development in ways that support inclusive growth, transparency, institutional development, and future generations. In Russia itself, the U.S. should support the development of a wider middle class, private enterprise, the rule of law, and the institutions of civil society. Which brings us back to the continuing importance of the work of the Eurasia Foundation, its partners, and its supporters. Your move to a Eurasia Foundation network has been a smart adaptation to the challenging and changing circumstances. The activities that I've described in Russia, in the European and Asian neighbors, grow out of the networks that the Eurasia Foundation has encouraged. Your projects supporting independent journalists, the institutions of justice, community, civil society groups, internet freedom, and the very important fellowships are the enablers of this future. I also hope that you can focus on special challenges for girls and women. At the World Bank Group, we stress that gender equality is not only the fair and right thing to do, it's smart economics. Our research revealed how attention to limits for girls and women, formal and informal, could make a big difference for economies, societies, and critically, the future generations. And we also learned that successful transformations have to be grounded in local capacities, institutions, and cultures. Over the past year and in many jobs, I've observed that the most vital ingredient for effective, resilient reform is local ownership. Outsiders can help with assistance, experience, even financing, but the reforms will not succeed without local ownership. And that's the case for your work, too. The process of change for Russia and its neighbors will continue. And I look forward to the Eurasia Foundation and its network of partners making even more contributions to that dynamic in the years ahead. So take pride in the accomplishments of 20 years and put them to work for the future yet to come. Thank you.